We're in the Listen Gallery now, in the first floor gallery, and I'm talking to John McCracken. And one of the resonant phrases, John, that comes to mind when I look at these works is that one of your preoccupations is the interface between the physical and the imaginative. And the sense I get from the works we're looking at now, it certainly refers to that that idea. We're looking at works, in fact, that I believe were constructed from sketches from the mid-60s, but constructed in the 90s. We're looking at a magenta work called Pylos, dated 1965, with a slot through the centre of it, horizontal, about 1¾ meters by about 1 meter. Perhaps we should start by you talking about this piece.
This is from the first group of sculptures I made in the 60s, and is of the type that I first showed in 65 in Los Angeles at Nick Wilder Gallery. There was this whole series of forms that most of which had slots in them. Some were more than one part put together, but still a basically rectangular form with a slot in the face. And the slot kind of made the pieces, to my mind, look a little bit being-like, as if they were sort of helmets or sort of a little bit humanoid what's that word, anthropomorphic or something like that. So I kind of gave them names accordingly, like this one is Yarmouk, and others were names of Greek islands like Ios and Mykonos and so on. With these, the inside and outside is it's kind of there by virtue of the rectangular form and the slot that gives access to the inside. This business of inside and outside and the two worlds is an idea that I gradually kind of figured out over the course of time. With these sculptures, I don't think I was all that aware of that way of seeing them. It was an intuitive business I was just kind of making use of in devising the pieces. They almost came out of nowhere. I just sort of got an idea and went with it in a kind of free way. In fact, I almost felt that these were as if they were beings coming from someplace and using me as a medium to get here. I almost had that feeling. It was kind of a strange feeling. I should mention I was trying to make things that were real simple, too. Right from the first, I was consciously on a kind of minimalizing track, and I was trying to get things that make things that were simple but had being, seemed to have kind of just a sense of being or existence. So the idea of beings transporting themselves here and showing up as material objects in the earth reality was kind of an apt idea, because it was just what I was trying to do. Not that I was trying to actually create an illusion of a living being hanging on the wall, but the sense of presence and so on that I wanted to get was one of the most important factors in doing these things. What I think and what I feel too is that form has the capacity to speak, so to speak, or just of itself and through itself communicate. And what form is communicating is kind of hard to define, and it gets into the area of intuition and so on. But what I hope and hoped and presently hope with these things is that They say more than look, I look like a being. They somehow speak of sort of almost philosophical level ideas and so on.
Shall we move now to another piece?
Yeah.
Now, John, we've just turned right and we're looking at a piece called Yarmouk. Again, it's dated 1965, the medium being lacquer on wood. I'm intrigued by the titles. Why Yarmouk for this piece?
Well, one way I arrive at them is to make lists of words that just appeal to me and seem like likely titles, and then I sort of let them sit a while until I'm sure that they're usable, and I just kind of assign them to pieces. It's kind of an intuitive thing. Again, it's almost like how I think up the forms. When I think up forms, it's just the form that I'm concerned with when I'm thinking of a sculpture. And so I make my thinking in 3D form itself, rather than words or reasons or principles or mathematical proportions or anything like that. And the same is kind of true with the words. I just I like words a lot, and I write a lot, but I just try to get words that seem to be okay as titles, and not too distracting, and not too claim-making. Part of the impetus to name things too is because if you don't, then they get called or titled untitled, and that just gets to be a drag to have a thing referred to as untitled, blah blah.
It might be interesting at this point to discuss what I suppose I could call the formal repertoire of your work. I don't like the word repertoire, but there is a fairly rigorous set of parameters that the works relate to formally. And when you start by making a work, I know that these were constructed from 60s diagrams, but you still work within quite rigid, if you like, parameters of formal structure. Mm-hmm. So how do the individual pieces arrive? I mean, are they developed over a period of time through a series of drawings, or do you consciously stick to a set of the formal elements, rectilinear, solids, verticals, two-dimensional structures?
I guess I do kind of both. Some things I may have done sketches of any number of weeks or years previous, and then I take them another step or two and then make them into pieces. And other things I just visualize and kind of visualize in midair space, and then make a drawing of it and go from there and make it. But again, I just sort of go into a mode where I'm thinking and attempting to think in just pure form. I just sort of think, well, what form would right now make it, so to speak, or be right? You know, be right, just say the right thing and feel right. And then I'll go to, after visualizing it in my mind, I'll go to visualizing it in a room and to get the size and the shape and the proportion in relation to human beings. And then sometimes I'll measure that invisible thing I have standing or leaning in the room or sitting in the room and move to paper or to a computer or whatever and make the final drawings and adjustments and then finally the plans for it.
That thing you mentioned about the scale and relationship to human beings and human scale is something I wanted to explore with you when we go downstairs and look at the pieces called planks up against the wall. Uh-huh. Now we're looking at two white vertical columns called Argos, and to begin with, they have no colour, they're completely white. Tell me about this piece.
Actually, it's kind of a light grey. The actual colour, which is sort of colourless, is a kind of light grey, a sort of neutral white grey. What you have is this slot made into a space between two elements. One thing I found with this whole series of works was that the forms needed to have access, and the slots and spaces and cutout areas afforded that access. Like, to slide these together, that gives you a different kind of piece, but then it's closed and sort of has no psychic access to it. So later I figured out that what that's about is that the inside-outside kind of business. All my works, at one point or another in my own mind, I relate to human beings, or that is, I use human beings as a metaphor for what I'm trying to do. So there's a figurative element in a way in all my works. And so what I reason is, well, humans have an outside and an inside. They're a physical body and a mind, or a soul and all that sort of thing. And with a human, when you have contact with a human, you're concerned with contacting the physical human and the mental human too, kind of getting inside each other's minds, that kind of business. And so for me, it's completely appropriate that the sculptures have that same kind of accessibility. So you not only see an object, you see one way or another, you see inside the object too.
The slot actually goes right through it, doesn't it?
Yeah. And also there's, I try to be a little bit careful too about giving the impression that I can explain everything about my work, because I don't think I can. I don't think artists necessarily know everything about their own works, but there's another aspect too, like to a piece like this, and that is architecture and kind of monuments, ancient ruins, and things like Stonehenge type things, and all that sort of thing too, that enters into the feeling that I was after in coming up with a form like this.
Two other things come to mind. One of which is the fact that you've written about how impressed you have been with Egyptian architecture and sculpture because of the surfaces and the forms and so on, ancient Egyptian. And then, of course, the inescapable idea that comes to mind here is Brancusi. I don't know whether you'd make that connection yourself.
Yeah, some, but particularly to ancient Egyptian stuff and their sculptures and so on. I was struck by how the Egyptians seemed to be able to take heavy, solid matter and make it into idea, just make it into pure idea, pure thought. To me, that was kind of like a magic thing to do. And so I think much of my own approach has some relation to that, the business of having an object that can appear to be pure idea, or can appear, especially with the more reflective pieces, to dematerialize or look as if they were a projection instead of an object.
I think in the past you have been interested in Jungian ideas and surrealism, which is about ideas and conceptual flights of fancy, if you like, or fantasy.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. I'm not at all happy to be simply trapped, so to speak, or ensconced in a physical world, and that's that, with a beginning and an end. I'm just not happy with that idea at all. So I one of the aspects of my work is to break out of that and to suggest that isn't the case as far as our reality goes and all that.
How do you think that view defines you from artists that have been given this minimalist label, such as Judd and Andre? I mean, that would seem to me to be quite a move away from the way in which that constituency of work is defined.
I guess it is, actually. I don't know. I wouldn't try to define what their form of minimalism or approach to minimalism might really be, but it seems to me that most of those guys were kind of mostly into getting the sense of presence and getting the sense of uniqueness, like Judd's specific object kind of idea, which I thought was real good. But I don't know that any of them kind of outwardly or blatantly try to suggest that there's a beyond to be brought into the picture also. I think maybe my use of more sensuous surfaces and all that indicated my penchant to do that sort of thing probably more than most of those people, except you look at, say, a Dan Flavin, which is a piece that uses light as a medium, and pretty soon you're probably going to think of spiritual ideas or thoughts or whatever. So I wouldn't try to claim that there's just a break between what they do and what people like that do and what I do or try to do.
One thing that intrigues me is, how do you decide on the particular color?
I'm actually glad you asked that, because I really think of form first, most always, and then color comes second, usually. It's kind of like the title comes later also, or like you're devising a human and you're making a human. Well, the color of the hair and the color of the skin and the color of the eyes and all that kind of probably comes after you've got most of the bones and the major structure in there, and the shape and the scale and all that. So I do tend to think first in terms of form, but on the other hand, color is the material I think in terms of using. You know, I mean, these pieces are made of wood and lacquer and so on, but the way I think is that they're made of color. So this yellow piece is really made of yellow. That's the material of it. So it's the stuff I use to give, just to give substance to the form ideas I have. I think of color as being an emotional element also. Color by itself is almost like the rational mind, and then or a rational idea or something, and then the color brings the sort of emotional and tactile aspect. And so I never did want to do pieces that were boring, and it seemed like color and surface allowed them not to be boring, so that a viewer would sort of look at a form in the first place, and then maybe kind of pick up what the form is and enjoy looking at it while experiencing the form, instead of being kind of bored. I mean, some minimal artists seem to kind of want their pieces to be boring for a while. That was sort of an aspect of work, but I never did want that.
I think we'll go down to the lower gallery.
Okay.
So now we're downstairs in the main space, and there's a piece here called Sephron, 1988. It's polyester resin, fiberglass and wood. It's a piece that, in fact, again, it relates to the human scale in the sense it's about 8 feet high by 2 feet wide, so you can get a sense of a barrier or something that you couldn't pass. It's in a material that's black resin, fiberglass and wood. And one thing that strikes me about all the pieces, really, is this incredible surface that they have, which, in a sense, makes them quite ambiguous in terms of their form. They've got a dimension, they've got a resonance that is to do with light. How do you view the surface that they have? It's clearly a very conscious part of the work.
Yeah, well, after those slotted pieces, I started using resin as a final surface, instead of lacquer, instead of sprayed lacquer. And the way I used it was to pour it onto the surface one side at a time, so that the colored stuff, the resin, is about an eighth of an inch thick. And this gave me a basically flat surface, which I then sanded and polished. Spent a lot of hours sanding and polishing. And the only way you can finish this stuff is to polish it. So I was sort of fated to go ahead and polish it fully. Actually, that's not quite right. The pieces I made after those slotted ones, I still used lacquer for a while and polished that. The surfaces got more and more polished. And then that evolved into using the resin. But the fully polished surface just seemed, I don't know, I don't think I reasoned out that I want to use a polished surface now. It just seemed right at some point. But it turned out that polished surface gave that access to the form that the earlier slots and cutout areas and spaces had given. So I didn't need to have those slots anymore in order to have a piece have the sense of materialness and interiorness, or in this case, transparency and so on. It kind of gave another dimension to the pieces. So the business of a piece seeming to be physical and solid, and then almost in some light conditions or in some from some viewpoint seeming to disappear, became an element I started using.
Or reflect its immediate surroundings, or indeed the viewer.
That too. They then include everything around them in the three-dimensional business that's going on, which is true of every three-dimensional object anyway, but maybe accentuated or pointed to because of the reflectivity.
There's a sense of, I don't know whether it's luxury or a sense of the sumptuous when you look at the surfaces. Is there a relationship that you would make? I mean, you've been based in Los Angeles for a long time, and the actual surface of, for instance, elegant luxury automobiles is one that, again, embodies this sense of the sumptuous, of the luxury. Is that something that affects these pieces, or would you say that's completely irrelevant?
No, it is. It is relevant. I was attracted to automobile finishes and so on, and even surfboard finishes, but mostly automobiles. Very early in the '60s, and it was almost like cars driving around were just readily available color chips or color samples or finish samples and all that. I was really attracted to finishes that were really custom done. So there was no orange peel or anything. Just a really sensuous, perfect finish kind of thing. So I tried to get a similar kind of look. Somehow it just seemed to suit my desire to make sort of transcendental pieces or pieces that not only again were physical but that suggested transcendentalness and kind of extra beauty and extra dimensionalness, that kind of thing.
Which is a property that, of course, manufacturers of consumer products want to embody in what might be kind of humble objects like refrigerators and so on. They want it to seem like this is a million-dollar experience.
That's right. That's
through its surface.
Right, yeah, right. Or cars too. They're green machines.
So now we're looking at a piece that is, I think, a cerulean blue almost on the wall-mounted piece called Water, 1996. Again, polyester resin, fiberglass, and wood.
This is the first. It's just kind of a small matter, but you notice that from the end it's a square. So from the end it's a square, but from the front it's a long rectangle. But it's the first wall piece I've made that is a square section like that. I avoid symmetrical or measurements, or I've kind of tended not to make cubes. I have made a few cubes, true cubes, but I usually tend to make things that are a little bit off from being too balanced, because the cubes just kind of sit there. So anyway, I just sort of got the idea of, again, it was a feeling thing. I don't think I would have made this 10 years ago or 3 years ago or whatever. It's just it seemed right to make a piece of these exact proportions when I made it.
I mean, it's interesting that many of the other works in this downstairs gallery, formal geometric structure has been, in a sense, dislocated. Other works, you know, don't conform quite so perfectly to this long rectangular solid. So what made you deviate from that idea of wanting to intervene or change or alter or move away from the predictable?
Yeah, now are you talking about this work now, or say works like that other one over there where there's an angle cut off of a rectilinear shape?
Yeah, that's what I define as the ones where you've wanted to make some sort of intervention to undermine the geometric regularity of the form. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the piece opposite Water, you've retained the integrity of a regular geometric solid.
That's an interesting distinction, and I think it is pertinent to talking about this piece too, because this one does kind of line up with the room and our, you know, the regular room sort of thing where the walls are vertical and the floors are horizontal and so on. And pieces like that angled one over there differentiate more from the space. And the thing is, differentiation is something that I always want a sculpture to do. I always want it to be in a space, but not so much a part of the space that it just seems integral with it. I want it to be also separate, like a visitor. And again, I think of the human stance as being the same. I think all humans are visitors, and I myself prefer the thought that I'm a visitor rather than that I'm just you know, only a part of the surroundings. So that maybe that's why it was a little bit unusual for me to make a piece like this square one, or this sort of balanced rectangular one that that simply sat in a space and didn't differentiate too markedly from it. I think I was just trusting the medium itself to differentiate anyway, even though it, of course, the color and the surface seemed to pull that off, you know, as well as even the rectangular form. By the way, the color of this, what I try to do with the color is, again, use it as a material. But the way I think is that what I've done is to go somewhere and find a load or a deposit of blue, say for this one here, and just cut out that shape, and then bring it back here, like as if I'd gone to another planet or someplace that was undiscovered, and I found all this blue stuff, and I just cut a shape out and present it as a pure blue shape.
In fact, you've mentioned in the past, I don't know to what extent they're tongue-in-cheek references, but you like the idea of these objects coming into the world almost through you as a mediator, but almost from sort of alien sources, that they seem to come from the unconscious, they seem to just have a life of their own.
Yeah, that's actually right. I do think in terms of bringing things here from another point of consciousness or point of view, and it's I do put my tongue in my cheek just a little when I say that I try to make pieces that appear to have been left here by a UFO or to have come from an advanced species of intelligent beings or something like that. But on the other hand, that's kind of exactly what I'm trying to do. I even go so far as to try to imaginatively become such a being when I think of works, and then to think, well, what shall I bring to the Earth dimension this time? So it's a little bit, you can't help but kind of be a little tongue-in-cheek about it, but on the other hand, it's quite seriously a part of the method I use and the sense I want to have in my works. It's kind of logical and expectable that people would compare my work sometimes or think. Compare my work to the 2001 monolith, because that piece had exactly that whole kind of business about it, and it's appropriate that people even think that I designed that monolith, which I didn't. But on the other hand, there's a sharing of interest in that. It's possible that whoever did design it, by the way, had seen my work, and so I could claim to have had a part in, coming up with that form, but.
I think undeniably they have a powerful symbolic presence, but that presence is elusive and that symbolism is elusive. You get a sense that they're about something else as well as being about themselves, and it's that other that is the intriguing element that one goes away with somehow.
Yeah, I would like to have it almost feel to a viewer that a sort of alien but friendly and interesting presence had been encountered or interacted with.
For that reason, I find it not easy or obvious to relate them to the minimalism of Judd or Andre. They seem to occupy another sort of space.
Yeah, they do, I think. Again, some of those works, I think, even of Judd's and Andre's, which are kind of factual and maybe tend to be cooler than my work. Still, that's sometimes you can kind of think in those terms. Maybe these guys did something similar to what I talk about, but just chose not to talk about it or something. I don't know. On the other hand, it does seem. It does seem kind of obvious that my work has a different sort of character to it, with its more insistence, more insisting kind of stance in that area.
Shall we walk over to two pieces now that I know you are very well known for, works that lean up against the wall, that I think originated from the idea of planks, and they still have a powerful presence. So now we have a piece called Gate, 1995, and Our Makua, 1995, and they relate to an earlier piece which refers to a plank leaning up against the wall. And as I say, you're perhaps best known in terms of my knowledge of your work by these particular works. Perhaps you could elaborate.
I do. I call these planks also. I decided when I first made a leaning form to call it a plank, except I also at that time made one that was wide and thin, and that seemed to me to be a sheet. So the thing is, at that time I was into naming pieces kind of factually. So I did a slab-like piece in yellow, so I called it yellow slab in two parts, and that led to my trying to stay factual and just calling the planks, because they did seem to be planks, or boards. Boards was another word, but I just liked the word plank better, so I used that. So I do call these planks also, and they're probably the most minimal things I ever did, ever kind of managed to make. After I had done kind of block-like things and slab-like things and so on, I sat down and I thought, well, what can I do that's simpler? Is there any way if I can just be more reductive yet and still have something interesting? And I looked over at the wall and where I'd had pieces of plywood and so on leaning against the wall that I had used to build these block-like things. And so I thought to myself, well, I guess that's it. I guess I just make a leaning board then. And that led to the planks, which do seem to have become the form most often identified with me. When people hear my name, if they know my name at all, they probably know it in relation to the plank forms. So it occurred to me finally that what I was making was something that represented a bridge between the two worlds, or a connecting form or device between the two worlds of physical and non-physical. And also something that for a while even kind of bothered me about the plank forms was that they lean at an angle, and in a way they sort of screw up any room you put them in, because they don't line up with the room in a totally comfortable way. They bring an angle into the room that kind of messes things up a little bit. And for a while that bothered me, but then I finally realized that I like that also, and it's part of really what I like doing with work, make something that is a little bit not off, but altered, you know, and that to my mind suggests the business of making a crack in space or a doorway in space or making something that's suggestive of a way out of the world, or a way into the world of spiritual matter or mental matter.
There is another tension which I find interesting, which is that of the idea of a plank against a wall. It's a temporary event. It's there only for a short period of time before it's moved. And yet these pieces have a certain monumentality, and yet they're still leaning up against the wall. Yeah, so there's those two things that work against each other.
That's a good point, actually, that temporality or the temporariness. Again, I think in terms of being in the world here temporarily and not rooted, you know, or not overly sort of connected to things. I mean, I wouldn't want to bolt one of these things to the wall or bolt it to the floor, even though I have put tape on the floor on occasion and tape on the wall to keep the things from falling over or keep people from knocking them over. The business of a work kind of maintaining a floating character is what I think the planks do, maybe better than any of the other pieces do, as a matter of fact.
I'm here at Matt's Gallery in the East End with Lucy Gunning, whose current show continues her interest in the voice. Addressing the uncertainties of communication, her hesitant voices resonate across the gallery. The five old TV monitors placed on tables and steps add to the viewer's feelings of fragmented memories. Walking round the gallery, the voices tantalisingly start and stop, frustrating your ability to capture them. Lucy, your current work's got a very different feel, I think, from Climbing Around My Room and Horse Impressionist, which people are quite familiar with. Can you talk a little bit about this new piece?
As you said, the new piece has come out of a continued interest in the voice. I think the early work, perhaps, I suppose that this current work is more serious. I think it's, whereas there is more sort of pleasure or desire in the early work. And I don't fully know myself yet why that is, but I think the early work was work that I just made. You know, I didn't necessarily know where it was going to go or what it was going to do, whereas this work and the City Racing Show are both commissioned pieces. I don't know whether that makes a difference in terms of the actual playfulness of a piece of work, even though I think certain things about this work are.
I was struck when I walked into the space here, the way that the furniture, the table, the little steps you've used, and the monitors, which are all very different sizes, placed at different levels, really adds to the whole resonance of the piece. And I'd just like you to talk a little bit about that selection in relationship to what is happening on the screens.
I think so often in video, the actual way in which the work is actually shown is ignored. The actual projector or the actual monitor are not generally part of the work so often, and I wanted to acknowledge them sort of wholeheartedly, I suppose, and not sort of expect the viewer to suspend their disbelief that they're kind of looking at this little box or, you know, with it looking within the frame, because that isn't what I am doing. I'm not dealing with the frame, you know, of the TV monitor, in a sense. And so the whole thing, I wanted to, the whole thing to be of importance. And it has a kind of knock-on effect. If you're acknowledging the actual monitor, then where you place the monitor, how you place the monitor, then also becomes important. And the fact that most monitors are from a domestic situation, so therefore the furniture is sort of semi-domestic, I suppose. And I've used a set of steps and placed a monitor at the top of the steps. That also kind of refers back to more of a domestic situation. And just sort of referencing a conversation, I suppose, where a conversation might happen.
I was also intrigued by the first thing that happens when you walk in is you catch these fragments. And you are frustrated trying to really zoom in on them and catch them as they go on and off. And I'd just like you to talk a little bit about the people you used and the conversations that they're having and the way that you've set up the piece in this very particular way to deal with the voice and communication, which is something you've been talking about in your work for quite some time.
I filmed each person individually. They each came to meet me, and it was very much a one-to-one situation where I just set up the camera and let it roll, and I asked them questions. Initially, I wanted them to be talking about quite specific things and stammering over or being hesitant or over certain words or certain subjects. And through doing it, through actually initially sort of starting to film, I realised that there's absolutely no control over, you know, when someone does actually trip up or trip themselves up over a word or what they actually will hesitate on or pause on, or, you know, it's completely beyond your control and certainly their control. So I had to go to a huge length to sort of try and make things happen, which at times felt rather sadistic. But and in fact, quite often when I switched the camera on, the minute I switched the camera on, someone would actually stop stammering completely and their speech would be perfect. And it sort of tapped into that whole thing almost, even though they weren't performing as such in terms of acting, you do take on a certain kind of role, or there is a certain amount of adrenaline that happens when you are actually being filmed or recorded or represented in a different way. Certainly one of the people that I filmed who had tremendous problems speaking on the telephone when I initially contacted her, and then when she arrived to be filmed, her speech was perfect. We went to huge lengths to try and activate her stammer, but what I'd noticed on the telephone through speaking to her was that she actually was quite often struggled over the name of something or the title of something, because they are all words that you can't avoid, that you can't replace with another word. And so I did have a thought in the back of my mind that perhaps I would make her read out all the universities out of the Yellow Pages, which is what in the end I had to resort to, which was, out of all the people that I filmed, it was much more of a kind of performance, I suppose. Although there is some struggle there, and I think many people who do speak very fluently perhaps do find a tremendous amount of discomfort in watching somebody struggle over a word.
Yeah, I was very interested in what you were saying earlier about the kind of almost sadistic nature. And one thing that struck me as well was the fact that, I mean, did you purposely selected people, or did you, that had speech impediments? I mean, how did you actually, I mean, did you know these people beforehand, or?
I advertised specifically for people. I did not ask for people with speech impediments. I didn't ask people who stammered. I did contact initially a speech therapist who put me in touch with the British Association of Stammerers, and I advertised in their newsletter and had a lot of replies, and subsequently filmed 7 people, of which I used 5. I don't necessarily like using the word stammering or speech impediment. I particularly speech impediment. I mean, in a way, if you start to examine our speech, we all have kind of glitches or pauses or hesitancies in our speech, and there are just varying degrees of that.
I was struck by the way in the Horse Impressionist piece how that you'd heard somebody initially making this sound, and it kind of activated ideas, and then you were searching for this person. And I wondered whether in this piece whether there was a similar starting point, or whether it just grew out of general thoughts you were having about communication.
In a way, it's a development into language. I haven't used language in my work at all, and I myself have been quite hesitant about doing so, and it's almost something that's kind of a representation of that, the work coming into language, but it is a hesitant voice.
The other point about the piece is the way that the voice starts and stops, which we discussed before, and the way it echoes round the room. And I'd just like you to talk again a little bit about how you've done that, this idea of almost chasing after the voice that you become engaged with as soon as you see the piece.
Well, the way that I've installed the piece, it was with the intention of using the space as much as I could. And the viewer is pulled around the space by the voice. They follow and try and catch up with, you know, with somebody who's speaking. And I mean, it is a difficult piece of work to view. And I think there's a tremendous amount of frustration in terms of kind of sort of that process of trying to catch what someone is saying, and then only to find them struggling over a word too, you know. But somehow, for me anyway, it kind of reiterates perhaps that kind of thought process that is involved in struggling over a word, or the repetition of a word, or the not being able to say a certain word, or the... I think I've tried really hard with this piece of work to make it transcend the kind of vocabulary that people give to stammering, or what other people have used the word speech impediment, which is a word I haven't used at all. But I was rather horrified actually when I saw Sarah Kent's review, and where I felt that she kind of reduced the work to stammering and speech impediment, and I feel as if I tried very hard to kind of go beyond that and speak about the way in which we all communicate, and the voice, and the way, for me anyway, it's that the what interested me was the way that the body, the voice coming out of the body, but it was almost like the body interrupting the voice, the body kind of resisting saying a word. And yet the mind is really trying to say that, and it's that kind of some sort of conflict there that really interested me. A stammer actually has quite an anarchic relationship to language in terms of the way it disrupts language and the speech, but almost the kind of the poetic of the kind of the rhythm of it, and the way that it changes the delivery of a thought. It's almost like the body kind of resisting speech.
Just walking round the gallery, we can get a feel of how all these sounds are working together, and the echoes, yeah, and the echoes of the voices through the space.
Allowing your voice to dictate form, as opposed to having a form, say in music, you know, your standard sort of having your middle eight and stuff like that in your standard song, or in poetry writing, sort of your sonnets or villanelles or whatever. It's all free form, it's all open field. So you know, you take your voice and you take what you're trying to say, and you allow that or to create the form.
That was Lloyd speaking. He's a performance poet who lives and works in Cardiff.